I presented what I've done. Like, it literally took like 3 months. It was super basic stuff. You know, risk management is not that complicated. And so I presented that to the executive board. And the CEO listened to my presentation and he goes, "That's wonderful, Alex, but my life hasn't changed. As a CEO, I should be waking up and wanting to look at your risk map or risk matrix, and that should drive my day. But my life hasn't changed in any way based on what you've presented."
That was Alex Sidorenko, and this is the All Things Risk Podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk Podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. I hope you're all doing very well. And if you're based in the Northern Hemisphere, I hope that you're enjoying the summer. And if you're not, well, the summer will be rolling around in a few months. Today's episode is an interesting and insightful conversation about risk and the risk management profession. I haven't had too many episodes like the one we have today, and partially that's because risk management is the profession I'm in. And when I set out to do the All Things Risk podcast, I wanted to make risk and uncertainty concepts accessible to all of you. I wanted to share insights rather than make it too technical and jargon heavy. In short, this is not a show about the risk profession for risk professionals or any other corporate types. This is a show for everyone. And that's simply because risk is all around us. And as I say at the end of every episode, risk is life. Having said all that, there are a ton of interesting and useful things about the professional practice of risk management that are highly relevant to many contexts outside that profession and in our lives and in our societies. And my guest today also thinks the way I do. And we get into risk as a profession, and I think you'll get a lot out of it regardless of what you do in your day-to-day. My guest today is Alex Sidorenko. Alex is a risk management professional. He's the founder and CEO of something called the Risk Academy, and that is a consulting company and a website that aims to make risk management accessible to small and medium-sized companies, particularly those in Russia. And that's because Alex is a Russian-born Australian. He's a super interesting guy. He also currently lives in Spain. So that already might tell you that he's not your ordinary person. And most especially for this conversation, and as you'll hear, he thinks and acts counterintuitively, like any great risk management professional. And we get into loads of cool stuff. We discuss Alex's own background story, and that includes moving back to Russia and working there after several years living in Australia, working with large and small organizations, particularly at the executive and decision-making level. We also get into decision-making. We talk about cognitive biases and how to overcome them. We get into what's wrong with the risk profession. And I think that this aspect of the conversation has many lessons for other areas. We talk about managing risk in our own personal lives and loads of other great things. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Alex Sidorenko. Enjoy. Alex, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm looking forward to this.
Ben, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I mean, this opportunity is wonderful. You do know I love talking about risk and anything risk-related, so I'm happy to share some of my ideas, thoughts, and some of my life stories about risk management with your audience today.
Fabulous. That sounds really cool. And so, you know, we have to start with, so you're a Russian based in Barcelona. So that's probably got some, there's an interesting risk story, I'm sure, around that. So maybe we get into a little bit of your background and who you are and how you ended up doing what you do. That would be very interesting.
I think it may be even more complicated than that. Mm. I am a Russian-born Australian currently living in Barcelona. And my story in risk management really started in Melbourne when, just like everybody else in the world, after school, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And my family thought that risk management sounded very exciting. So completely coincidentally, I became the first ever graduate intake in undergraduate risk management at Monash University.
Okay.
So we were the first ever in the history of the country class of undergraduate risk managers. Now, that sounds exciting, but it's not really when you think about it, because Monash has no longer offering this course. We were the guinea pigs, I think, of a failed experiment.
That sounds cool.
I mean, that was really cool, because I did my degree in risk management, in corporate risk management, and nobody at the time kind of knew what it was all about. Now, luckily for me, I did it at the same time a second degree in statistics and econometrics. Mm-hmm. So at least I have some, you know, something real. proper foundations behind it. But it was so fun, because after university, I joined one of the big consulting firms, Big Four in Australia, in the department that was called risk management. It was called Enterprise Risk Services. And it had close to 100 employees, and not a single risk manager.
Right.
So like that was the paradox at the time. So everybody kind of talked about risk management, but there wasn't really any risk management per se. And that was in Sydney. That's when I moved to Sydney. So I worked for 5 years at the consulting company, and that really gave me exposure to some very exciting things. Mm-hmm. For example, we did the guide on risk management for the Australian Stock Exchange. Mm-hmm. And we went around all Australian states promoting risk management, because the Australian Stock Exchange was very unhappy about the level of compliance with the Principle 7. It's the one of the requirements for listed companies to do proper risk management and disclose how they do risk management in the annual reports, or disclose why they choose not to do risk management. Just one of the little things I love about the Australian approach, this if not, why not principle, and the whole principle-based approach to risk management. Mm-hmm. But it's really not compliance. You can't really do it right or wrong. It's up to you how you do it. So that was that was a very exciting start. But then at some stage, I think I got just my sort of life reaching a certain point where I wanted more excitement.
Yes. And life in the Big Four didn't do it for you, Alex? You know, the jet setting
in Australia in general is just it's so stable and nice, right, and easygoing and predictable,
right,
that I wanted something outrageous. Right. I wanted, as the risk manager, I felt I could take on the risk of uncertainty,
yes,
living somewhere else. So I thought, what would be an exciting place to be? And since I'm limited to two languages in my life, so you know my choices were somehow narrow, I chose Moscow, and I've joined a different Big Four firm in Moscow, and that was pretty exciting, because Russian market in terms of risk, in terms of consulting, is very different, very different maturity level, very different relationship with clients, very different pricing tags on most of the consulting projects. That gave me some interesting exposure. I became one of the co-authors of the global PwC risk methodology, and we went around the European offices trying to bring that to life. As far as consulting goes, that was pretty exciting at the time. But as life goes, that was nothing compared to then joining the industry,
right,
and actually becoming head of risk for first one of the biggest venture funds in the country, government-based venture funds, and then becoming head of risk for one of the biggest private equity, government-based
equity funds. Very cool. I'm curious about, a number of things we can dive in there, but just in terms of culturally, what you found when you went back to Russia. I'm a Canadian, and I spent 2 years, I went back to Canada for a couple of years, and even though I grew up in Canada, it was like moving to a different country in some ways, because I hadn't ever really worked professionally. I had never rented a place to live. I hadn't done, you know, those adult things. I'm curious as to what it was like for you, even though you spoke the language and everything. what was, and just speaking my episode with Tim Stanley, the rapid change that Russia went through. So, you know, you go away for a few years, you come back, I'm sure things are very different. So I'm just curious what that was like.
Funny you say that, because I mean, I was away for close to, I think, 12 years. So a long time. And I left as a child and I came back as a professional. So most of my business language was English. I even, for the first year, I was drafting letters and I was writing reports in English, even though I speak, you know, fluent Russian, but it's conversational Russian, not business Russian. So I was writing everything in English, and it was translated then by my colleagues into the Russian reports. Right. So that was a bit bizarre, but I quickly picked up the sort of the local things. You know, being in Russia really had a life-changing experience for me in terms of risk management, because I think the senior management in some of the Russian companies, and I was very fortunate. I worked for a private equity fund which was headed by ex vice prime minister of the country, and it was a very sort of fluid relationship because the team is very small, and so it gave a lot of opportunity to talk to different. Quite senior executives, and the turning point in my life really was, and that's sort of when it all hit home. Is when I joined the private equity fund in response to a number of findings by internal auditors, external auditors, Auditor General, Prosecution Office, and some other government agencies. So I was really brought in to respond to their sort of to their complaint that no proper risk management is in place. So I had to put something in place that would satisfy all of the surrounding organizations around the company. And that was exciting. I mean, I think this was probably the life-changing experience for me. It took me about 3 months to build like the foundations of what I was selling as a consultant in the past, you know, the sort of the most basic, like the frameworks, the profiles, the documents, the mitigation plans, like everything that you expect to have.
Yes.
And then something unexpected happened. I presented what I've done. Like, it literally took like 3 months. It was super basic stuff. You know, risk management is not that complicated. And so I presented that to the executive board. And the CEO listened to my presentation and he goes, "That's wonderful, Alex, but my life hasn't changed. As a CEO, I should be waking up and wanting to look at your risk map or risk matrix, and that should drive my day. But my life hasn't changed in any way based on what you've presented." And so, and then, like, it just became even funnier. It wasn't, it kind of wasn't that funny for me at the time.
It's very deflating. I can imagine.
But then it turns. But then he turns to another board member and he goes, "Do you use this as a tool every single day in your decision making?" And the board member goes, "I don't want to question the importance of risk management. I think it's important, but I don't use it every day." So he goes, "Okay." He turns to the second board member on the left and he goes, "Well, what about you? Do you use it every day?" And the board member goes, "I think risk management is important and it's a very valuable tool and we appreciate what Alex has done, but I don't use it every day." So the CEO turns to me and goes, "Well, you know, figure it out, because something is clearly not right. We have business people making business decisions every single day and they do it separate or sort of without the involvement of that risk discussion that you've created." And I mean, I think it was a very fair statement. Our risk management was a quarterly risk assessments type, you know, the common sort of activity. And when you talk about risks on a quarterly basis, but you take as a business risks every single day, numerous times, then something clearly doesn't work. Something's wrong. And that was partly attributed to Russian management being Russian. I started talking about the specifics. They really take no bullshit. And I think that's the key takeaway for me. The life expectancy of a risk manager in Russia is probably slightly more than a year. That's how much it takes a senior manager, CEO, to realize that, you know, his world is not changing. Mm-hmm. So why is he going to continue paying somebody mm-hmm. a salary? Mm-hmm. So that was a really big wake-up call, and we've changed everything. Mm-hmm. In the following months, we've completely redesigned our thinking around risk management. We moved heavy into the cognitive biases, risk mm-hmm. perception, mm-hmm. moved heavily into integrating into how businesses make decisions. For us, it was investment decisions. For us, it was budgeting decisions. Mm-hmm. So it's slightly easier. It was only like two major processes that we completely redesigned with risks in mind mm-hmm. so that risks become a consideration every single time the decision is being yes. made. And that, for us, that was about 15 times a week.
Sure, right. That's a very powerful experience. And actually, I think it's fortunate for you that it happened at that point in your career. I think a lot of career-minded professionals in a variety of fields, doesn't have to be risk management, but when I think one of the valuable things is risk management is a fairly new thing overall, but also pretty new in Russia. And you really started to connect with, well, what's the purpose of what it is I'm doing? With, you know, how is it making a difference in, you know, my clients and what people are doing? How is it adding value? And you got right up to the coalface of trying to figure that out. And I think a lot of people go through their careers, particularly working in big organizations, and they don't really connect to those things. They don't really get to connect to those things, particularly if you're working with a, you know, like a big four. If you enter one of those types of places, it's great for experience, but at some point you have to connect with what it is you're doing and how it's changing people's lives. And if it's not, you do come to that realization that, shit, I need to change course. So I think it sounded like a very valuable lesson, and you got that opportunity to just really connect with how people are using what it is you're doing, which must have been, you know, beautiful risk maps and all of that wonderful. If you're not involved in risk management, you know, we can produce some nice looking outputs with lots of colors and things like this. But if it isn't useful to people, then you know, you begin to question it. You do question it, yeah.
And I think that sort of that led me to some very valuable lessons. And I'm not sure how universal those lessons necessarily are. I can't really argue that this is the only way forward, mm-hmm. but I've chose that this is the only way forward for me mm-hmm. in the company. I've learned a few lessons from that. First one is that if you're talking about risk, it has to be talked about in the context of something bigger. Mm-hmm. So you have to be talking about risks when formalizing a budget, when you put together a business plan. Yeah. You have to be talking about risks when you are making investment decisions or yeah. when you are planning for project budgets or project schedules.
Yeah. And if you're an individual, if it's, you know, you're making a major, whether it could be a career change or you're thinking about moving to a new country or you're thinking about starting a new business or something like that. Yeah.
I did a risk budget for my wedding. And it was lucky that I did. My wife constantly uh-huh. tried to get into the sort of the reserve that we had set aside for contingencies. Mm-hmm. So that like that really that experience, speaking with the CEO honestly and the other board members honestly, told me a few very interesting lessons. Probably the second lesson and the biggest one is that we're so encouraged in our profession to be facilitators mm-hmm. and methodology experts and training experts, which is kind of sitting on the fence most of the time. Mm-hmm. We say we're just there to collate the information, present the information, do some basic analysis yeah. and sort of...
And you and guys make the decisions and yes. Yeah. Yes.
And I had a wonderful conversation, another conversation mm-hmm. with the CEO when I was presenting some other things. He said, I don't want a person sitting on the fence. Mm-hmm. I mean, he does want a person sitting on the fence, but that person will be paid as the person who's sitting on the fence. So it's a very low sort of skill, mm-hmm. low importance job, who's there just to keep for compliance purposes, mm-hmm. to have some sort of documentation rolling. Mm-hmm. But, you know, clearly this is not our aspiration. We as risk managers think we deserve an equal seat at the board table and an equal remuneration to the other board members, which is bizarre because all the other board members take personal responsibility and have a lot of ownership, have a lot of accountability. And sometimes in investment, for example, they have a lot of skin in the game because they put their own personal money in the investments that they are proposing to prove that they, you know, that they're behind it.
Sure.
Which is kind of weird because there are sort of four people like that who are very involved in day-to-day operations, and there's the risk manager who's sitting. I'm getting paid the same as you guys, but I'm just a methodology expert and a facilitator. So that clearly doesn't quite work in you know, in just doesn't sound logical. Why would somebody pay a person who's not contributing much? Is it the same as the people who do all the work? So for me, the biggest takeaway, the second takeaway was that I think the future of risk profession and just the future approach to risk management may need to change where the risk manager actually takes ownership of some of the analysis and does not necessarily rely on the information solely provided by the other business units, but has his own sources of information where he can create some insight, some analysis where he can contradict or confirm some of the other management positions, but he basically needs to have enough ammunition to say something at the board table which will be unique because nobody else thought about it or nobody else have said it before, because they're hiding something or because they're
they have different incentives. So we talk about cognitive biases. They, you know, they have a, you know, the confirmation bias going on or an omission bias or something that's happening that is not giving the organization the full picture of what it's getting itself into.
Exactly. And, you know, saying what I've just said is easy. So risk management has to be an integral part of every single decision, and risk manager needs to have sufficient insight to be part of the game at the board table. So saying that is simple enough, but when you try to implement it,
it's a paradigm shift.
You immediately realize that A, most of the modern day risk management tools don't work because they take too much time, and you need to be able to produce risk and insight on a daily basis. So you need to use something else. And the second one is that humans are inherently, and I think this is where we're sort of moving into less professional risk space, but just general, you know, human life, is that people are actually not very good at thinking about risk and making decisions under uncertainty. And that's where, I mean, that was a few years ago. That's when I started doing a lot of research into the work of Nobel Prize winners like Daniel Kahneman or Vernon Smith, Amos Tversky, and like dozens others, including some, you know, very cool guys in the Russian universities that do a lot of research in neurosciences. And all of their combined like 60 years of research quite ultimately tells us that just because you've trained somebody to think about risk, or you've asked them nicely to talk about risk, or you've given them some high-level slogans and laws, and you know, feel-good statements that risk is part of everybody's responsibility, no one will care. It's just, it's so inherently deep inside our brain that we do not think about risks in business context,
absolutely,
in complex scenarios, that I had to rethink the whole approach to risk management. And we've been doing a lot of, you know, study and training in Russia to try and promote that side of risk management, the sort of the human brain side, how it works.
Could we maybe talk about that just a little bit? So Kahneman and Tversky, they wrote this book, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow, which is highly, highly recommended. And there's, you're right, there's a lot of work that's recently come out. I think all of this academic work has been around for a long time, but one of the things that really came out was the after the global financial crisis. You know, a lot of this stuff came out, and people started to look at it and say, "Holy shit!" You know, there's all this good stuff about how we make decisions, and we're not applying it to our organizations and you know, how we work and And these terms of cognitive bias started to make its way into the lexicon, but we still haven't really caught up. But maybe, I don't know if you could, we could talk about one or two examples of certain types of biases that we have that are very common when we make decisions. I don't know if anything springs to mind in particular.
Sure. I'll give some history behind that as well, because this is fascinating stuff. Whoever is listening to this right now should definitely find Daniel Kahneman's book, mm-hmm. at least Thinking Fast and Slow. Mm-hmm. It's a bestseller. So unlike all the actual academic research, mm-hmm. it's written in a very easy to understand mm-hmm. language, and it's easily digestible. So that essentially talks about the two frames of mind, the two systems in mm-hmm. our brain. We have system one thinking, which is the quick unconscious one, and that's what helps us survive. This is what we use for making day-to-day decisions. That's why we can play sports. That's why we can do million of things. That's what makes us human. But when it comes to uncertain situations, system one gives us a lot of errors. And those errors are consistent. So different people in the same situations would make the same mistakes. Mm-hmm. And they would probably make those mistakes time after time mm-hmm. after time after time. Our brain is just very powerful at deceiving ourselves. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we need to really start switching on the sort of system two thinking, which is analytical. It processes information. It tries to overcome our immediate tendency to lie to ourselves and to others. And risk management is essentially the kind of tool that triggers that system two in our brain. So we need to build a number of checklists, templates, examples, words, tools to help humans think about risks, because I think that's the biggest lie ever sold mm-hmm. to us by consultants mm-hmm. is that executives think about risk anyway when they make decisions. Mm. That is just not true. Mm. They think about some of the risks some of the time, mm-hmm. and they ignore 90% of the important.
Absolutely. And if you think about what it's like to be a leader of a major organization, a corporate, a business, even a small business, the amount of information that you have to process, and those fast thinking systems are really designed to provide a bit of an evolutionary advantage. You shortcut. You don't have to think through everything. So we do shortcuts and we work off of patterns. But as you say, that's prone to error. So you have, Jack Welch, who, listen to your gut and all of this stuff, which gut thinking comes from repetition of patterns, and so things come out and you can make a quick decision. But the stuff that you don't see coming are things that if you actually stop and take a look, you could figure it out, but if you go via your system one, you will miss. And that's why
there are, over the last 60 years, there have been discovered around 200 different cognitive biases, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and they continually being discovered, mm-hmm. the new ones. Mm-hmm. A lot of that information is available on just basic Wikipedia. There's a mm-hmm. page which is called List of Cognitive Biases, mm-hmm. As well as a lot of literature, obviously. But I have my favorite ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what are your favorite ones?
In investment decision making. Mm-hmm. So this is the first one. I always forget the sort of the official name, mm-hmm. but this is the essence of the cognitive bias. When things are good, people are risk averse. So when things are good, when you, for example, when you're trying to sell an investment, or when you're trying to sell your apartment, and it's a good market, mm-hmm. Nothing is bothering mm-hmm. you will be very risk averse. Mm. So you will settle for less money as long as you avoid the uncertainty. Like the uncertainty is just too much pressure for you. People are risk averse when things are good. From a risk management perspective, that's not bad. Like, it's not ideal. It's not economically viable because a lot of value is being lost mm-hmm. and left on the table. But it's not bad from a risk management perspective. What is bad is that these same people, 5 seconds later, when things turn bad, they become super risky. And this is just blows my mind. Mm. It's essentially sitting at the board table and you have your first project being discussed and everything's good. And everybody's super risk averse, mm-hmm. saying, no, let's not take any risk, let's not do anything mm-hmm. with it. And then like literally 5 minutes later, you turn to a second project and it's a bad project. It's a toxic investment. And everybody's suddenly going, let's put more money into it. Let's try and turn this around. Let's risk some investment. Let's do. And this is just mind blowing.
Yes.
The same person in the situation when everything's good doesn't like risk. Mm-hmm. And that very same person, when things don't turn that good, when things are uncertain or bad, becomes super risky. Mm. And this is something that we need to be aware is when we're in a situation when something doesn't feel good, when it's uncomfortable, we will be, our brain will be telling us to make more risky decisions. And that's very dangerous. I mean, that's how people, it's kind of selling your apartment when the market is down. And you will be making so many bad, risky decisions if you don't follow a proper structured process, like if you don't structure your brain, your thinking. So that's number one. The second one is the sort of the ever popular confirmation bias. It basically tells us that we see information and we interpret information through the lens of the decision that we've made in our brain. So once we made up our mind on something, on anything, for example, let's go to Thailand for holidays, our brain will ignore anything that contradicts this. So for example, you know, there may be a revolution, another colored revolution, our brain will find a reason to convince us that that is not significant. But if we'll see a picture of a beautiful beach and it will say welcome to Thailand, our brain will extrapolate that, giving it so much more significance, making us completely disregard the real risks. I'm not saying, you know, Thailand is a bad destination by any means, but I'm just saying confirmation bias is fun. It's fun. And the final, I mean, I have about 20 that I usually talk about in all different trainings. But the final one is called omission bias. And it basically tricks our brain to think that not doing anything is better and more ethical than doing something that is unpopular. And that's just... That is not just business. I mean, that's our day-to-day life. When we have to call and have a difficult conversation with someone, when we have to have a conflict with somebody at school or at work, our brain will tell us that it's better not to do anything than to do something that will make us uncomfortable. And that's just a lie. Normally, that just extrapolates them 10 times and it blows out sooner or later. And it's usually much worse than taking the sort of the stand or the decision. Yet this is how our brain works. It tricks us into thinking that it's better not to do anything. And there are dozens other
Fascinating. Yeah, they really are fun. And you kind of you can feel you can look back at decisions that you made and you kind of almost feel how those that was my Amazon Echo that just woke up for some reason. I don't know what woke it up. At any rate, you can kind of go back and look and see how that plays out whenever you make a decision. So I remember I was deliberating over this and that. So what you talk about has a lot of resonance. Are there any tips or tools just personally that you use to try and overcome some of these cognitive biases?
Absolutely. I think it has such a significant impact on risk management in general in our life, in our business, is that any kind of methodology, that is any kind of tool that is based on getting people's opinions and then interpreting those opinions as completely unreliable. But basically anything, you know how in a sort of in a typical risk workshop, you would do the interviews, you would collect the information, then in the workshop, you would discuss it. The science tells us that this probably has nothing to do with the reality because people don't really tell the truth most of the time because they have hidden agendas. But not only that, is the cognitive biases are so powerful that people think they're participating and they're contributing and they're sharing valuable information. But in fact, they're just their system one thinking, sharing some ideas, which may be completely missing the mark. So I've, for me, I've discovered two things. Is first one, and that's absolutely critical, is for every piece of information that you receive from the business, it has to be validated and verified.
Mm-hmm.
That means you have to either ask someone else in the business,
mm-hmm.
or you have to find an internal or external source of data that mm-hmm. will either confirm or deny that particular hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
So first rule for me was always verify every single word given mm-hmm. By a business, whatever that may be. And that immediately has a huge impact on how risk management works. Because by sitting in your office, you will not have enough data points, mm. enough access to information to be able to verify.
Yes.
You need to have a network of people within mm. the organization. So you need to be able to pick up the phone and ask head of legal,
mm-hmm.
is this true, what yeah. I'm being told?
Yeah.
Or you need to ask head of strategy or head of internal audit or head of compliance
mm-hmm.
or head of finance or a different mm. investment manager in another business unit. You need to know where to sort of immediately go. And it's a matter of, you know, 5 phone calls, like an mm. hour at some mm. at some stage mm. when an information is coming, it has to be presented to the board, and you need to verify whether it's in fact mm-hmm. truthful or not. And of course it requires risk managers to have a lot of access to the raw data
mm.
within the business. And of course, all the external resources like Bloomberg and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
You need to build your process in the way that you verify whatever is being told by the business.
Mm-hmm.
So at some stage, I've even created a methodology that for every investment decision that is going before the board, there is what we called a back office expertise mm-hmm. being done. So every decision, once it's sort of known that it will go to the board members next week, the sort of the essence of that decision is immediately circulated to head of legal, head of strategy, mm-hmm. head of finance, head of internal audit, head of risk, and a few other people.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, each of them have a checklist, which mm-hmm. risk management has created to check off what the issues may be. And that information is like, within days
mm-hmm.
is collated. So the risk manager and some of the board members see this is what business is proposing.
Mm-hmm.
This is what the sort of the quick back office expertise mm-hmm. tells us. If there's anything that deserves attention,
mm.
then we'll do proper analysis afterwards.
Sure, sure.
So that was the first sort of big one. The second big one for me was, if you want to be an equal, to have an equal say at the board table mm. or at any decision, you need to bring numbers to speak mm-hmm. with people who talk numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So if the investment team brings you the NPVs and IRRs,
yes. you need to look at those.
Else,
yeah,
you can't come back to them saying, we think there are high risks,
yes.
low risks,
yes.
medium risks.
Yes.
You have to be equal mm-hmm. maturity mm-hmm. in terms of discussing, you know, risk issues. So for me personally, I mean, I worked in a non-financial company. Mm-hmm. It was an investment fund, but it was an investment in private equity. So there was a lot of qualitative stuff. It's
mm-hmm.
it's not shares or bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that was scenario analysis and Monte Carlo simulation. So switching to tools that stop talking about risks per se. I, for example, gave up talking about risks at some stage in my mm-hmm. career. I started talking about what impact these uncertainties have on the final outcome. So if the investment team is saying, we think the IRR on this project is 25%, we can say, based on the risk analysis we have done, the IRR will be somewhere between -5% and 10%.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives a very different perspective. Or, for example, when the finance team prepared the long-term budget for the fund, they said we will have a cash surplus in 2018 of 1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, well, it looks like based on our analysis, the probability of having such a big surplus mm-hmm. is 3%.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality may look very different, and this is what the cash deficit
mm-hmm.
may look like, and those are the different scenarios that we have tested.
Yeah. I think there's some really good things there. And just to relate it to a few other concepts, perhaps outside of the risk space in which you you're working. I mean, I think the first thing that you talked about really is about information. And I think nowadays it's almost like, well, there's too much information, but there's also not necessarily any excuse if you're trying to make a decision and you've got, you know, you've got your biases potentially, and you just cast your net a little bit wider to sources of information that you might not have looked at when you're considering something. So talk to, you know, talk to people who've had a bad experience, or you know, look at the bad reviews on, you know, on TripAdvisor, whatever exactly. It is, you know, exactly. Just really challenge yourself. Go to the sort of the other extreme. Really challenge yourself. What are the people who, you know, who are the counterintuitive kind of contrarian viewpoints? What are they? What information? And just, you know, do a kind of a thorough look at mm-hmm. those other sources. And I think the second point that you made is when connecting with other people, it's speak their language. You know, mathematicians or people that are making investment decisions, they worry about the net present value of something. How, you know, what is the net present value of a particular investment? And if you go in and you don't speak their language, you will not connect with them. And that goes, I think, with any stakeholder that you have is what is it that's driving them? And this is the same with, you know, if someone's out there who's an entrepreneur and trying to connect with a customer, well, you've got to get in their heads, you know, and what is it that they want, and connect what you are offering to what they want. And if there isn't a connection, then you have to go back. But if there is, you need to frame it in a way that the stakeholder, the customer, whatever is how they're looking at it. Otherwise, they will not pay attention to you.
And that's absolutely it. I think we as a profession, and just broader than even risk management, we've talked about risk for too long. Mm. We've
created a jargon, right? We've got risk attitude, risk appetite. We've you know, risk impact, gross risk, net risk, and what that does is it creates, first of all, it does create a veneer that this is a profession. There's a science behind it, and you know there is some truth to that. But also what it does is it fails to connect. The more that we build those walls of jargon, the less we connect with our stakeholders.
Yeah, it's actually even more dramatic than that. You know, there are rubbish words like risk appetite and risk tolerances and all the other things. But I'm not even saying like that. That's part of the story. That's pretty bad. But what's even worse, even just in general, when we talk about risk, we pretend that we are doing what we're doing for the sake of managing risk, which I think is completely missing the point. Our risk analysis is one of many tools that managers use to help them make better business decisions, whether it be strategic decisions or investment decisions or their day-to-day operational decisions. Risk management is just a tool, one of many, in fact, to help improve the decision quality. Mm-hmm. It's not about dealing with risks. You know, you don't go, okay, so I know what the risks are, I know they're significant, so now I'm going to manage them. No, you're going to make decisions with risks in mind.
Yes.
And that's a very different ball game. Mm. And just on that topic, I've had, you know, one of my videos that I published on the Risk Academy channel on YouTube was, is risk management a profession or a tool, or a management tool? Which is, you know, completely outrageous for me to say, because I'm one of very few people in the world who are professional risk managers.
Yes.
I am now working for 13 years in risk. I'm now absolutely convinced that risk management is not a profession. Mm-hmm. It's just one of many management tools that are used for making decisions on a day-to-day basis. It's one of many tools that exist, and that, again, that really changes sort of the approach, changes our perspective of things.
Yes, it does. And you know, I know you have some views on and possibly controversial topics. I mean, I do think that there's a bit of a cottage industry around perpetuating some of the, you know, the myths, possibly that risk management around the validity, not myths, but overinflates the importance of some of these tools. And what you're trying to get at is the heart of risk in decision making. So I'm curious, just as a sort of profession, where you see the future, where does it lie in terms of how risk managers should where they should be and how they should work with organizations. Where do you see that going?
When I think about this, I think of four things.
Mm.
And the sort of the first one is very quickly realizing and accepting the reality that risk management is not about managing risks outside of some basic compliance risks, where it is purely about managing risks. But for this sort of, we always talk about creating value and being a valuable advisor. Well, for 90% of the other non-compliance related risks, which is not a legal requirement, risk management is not about managing risks. It's about making decisions with risks in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that means being there in person or methodology-wise for every single important decision that is being made in the business. And that's on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
That's not once a year. It's not once a quarter. It's not once a month.
Mm-hmm.
It's being there numerous times a day in different departments where the decisions are made.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first one for me, understanding that and having a critical think about how your methodologies are currently aligned with that. And I'm pretty sure 90% of the people are completely missing that that part. Now, I'm participating in the development and the update of the ISO 31000 from the Russian side. Right now, I'm
just collecting... for my listeners. Could you explain what ISO 31000 is?
So ISO 31000 is like the Bible of risk management. It's when back in early 2000s, hundreds of people from around the world came together and decided to create a single set of rules for risk management, a single set of principles, I should say. It's a standard. They came up with the ISO standard, ISO 31000, which is a guidance standard. It's not like a management system where it's a requirement to manage risk in a particular way. It actually gives you principles and overall framework and some ideas around how the processes may look like for risk management. So now it's being updated by close to 200 people from, I think, 30-something countries. I'm there from the Russian side trying to right now collect all the feedback from the Russian businesses to improve the standard in the future. And I think that's one of the messages that's coming out very strongly in the upcoming version of the ISO 31000, is that risk management is about integrating into what business does. It's not about managing risks for the sake of managing risk. So that's number one. But as soon as you say that, I think the number two becomes very apparent. You're basically saying, we need to take our tools, our risk tools, and integrate into what head of finance does, head of production does, head of commerce, head of procurement, and all the other people. And that immediately hits us like a wall, saying that those people don't expect us to see us. They're not going to be excited about making budgeting risk-based. They're not going to get excited about making procurement risk-based because there is a huge human component to risk. And that's where we move into cognitive sciences, hidden agendas, you know, unethical business practices. One of the biggest confusions is we kind of work under the presumption that business is good and ethical and nice. I mean, that just doesn't. I mean, that's not how I see business.
What you said was resonates. Just a couple of with a couple of other guests I've had episode. Now I'm getting losing track of my episode 5 or 6 with Alison Taylor, who's an expert on corruption. And she said, well, maybe the paradigm is that, you know, if business can get away with being corrupt, they would. So we need to work at it from the other lens. John Lark, who is episode 32, and he was on the, I think he was on the Canadian side of ISO 31000 for a number of years. He's not now, but he wrote a book on small and medium size and risk management for small and medium size enterprises. And what you say really resonates with you know, both of those approaches. That yes, you know, we need to come at it from a different lens in terms of looking at the nature of the nature of business and the nature of human behavior, which doesn't make one popular in going around and knocking on doors internally.
Exactly. And it's bizarre. It's bizarre that we work under the presumption that, which may not necessarily hold true. It's probably better in some countries, it's worse in some countries. I've had a lot of comments from people saying, in US or in UK or in Canada or in Australia, we are all, fluffy and white and nice. Don't kid yourself.
Yeah.
Businesses will do unethical things if they think they can get away with it. Mm-hmm. Exactly, as you said. So the second big theme for me was, if that's in fact is the situation, then we as professionals need to be very mindful about what the sort of human side of risk analysis is. Mm-hmm. We need to understand how people make decisions. We need to understand what drives them. For example, mm-hmm. I always say the first thing every risk manager must know by heart in their company is the remuneration policy.
You need to understand
how people are getting paid.
Yes.
Because they will do exactly what they're paid for. Mm. No more, no less. Mm. Just before the bonus payments are calculated, they will start making bad decisions. Mm. Because that's how human nature works.
Yes, yes.
So that's the sort of the second big thing, which I think will change how we think about risk and how we approach
risk. It's a very important point. And Tom Harden, who was involved in an insider trading situation in the U.S. and then became this tipper, one of the things that came through to me when speaking with him on that episode was that the risks that he took were actually very small. When you think about the overall, the overall consequences, both to him and in his life, but when you think about an extra $40,000, $46,000, in commissions or whatever, versus the potential downside, it's quite significant. And then when you look at organizations where people might take these huge risks on behalf of the organization in terms of reputational risks, just to get, a bonus, an extra bonus of 5 or 10%. That happens.
Yep.
That happens. So you have to look at that. Otherwise, it drives a lot of the behaviors. A corporate environment is an ecosystem, and people have, people act in certain ways based on what they're told to do. And it should be no surprise that if you give people targets, they're going to try and hit those targets. So
Exactly. And sort of picking up from that, the third point, which I think will drive the future of risk management, is if you're saying that risk management is about integration and you give appropriate appreciation to the fact that humans are not built for that, that means that the risk manager at some stage will have to do something by himself. Like he will have to drive. We like to think that, we're that mystical second line of defense where we create the methodology and then the business does it.
Yes.
It's just not going to happen. The CFO will continue to make the decisions that are in his best interest. Mm. And that may involve disclosing some risks, not disclosing other risks. Mm. So the third big, I think, trend for me is that the risk manager may need to get involved into the actual decision making. He may need to be at the table to have additional information for the executives to make those decisions. And that has a huge impact on everything the risk manager does. I mean, there may be instances, even though they're quite rare. I mean, the reality is, I told you, there was about 15 investment decisions per week. So imagine how many thousands of decisions were made over 3 years that I was with the company. And in those 3 years, out of the thousands of decisions that were being made, I only had twice or three times I had to write a Saturday memo to the CEO saying, we think the risks are too high. Let's not make this decision until you hear both sides of the story. You really had to step on it and get involved and become like an opponent to something quite rarely. So it's not like business is always evil. Mm-hmm. But the reality is to be able to stand up and say, we think this, you know, multi-billion dollar decision is not good and not get destroyed immediately after.
Yes.
Takes a lot of not only balls, but takes a lot of methodology. Like your tools, your approach, your data gathering, your insights, your connections with different people, all of this has to be bulletproof. You have to be able to defend something and defend it. Because I mean, what's the easiest solution for the executives to do when they hear an unfavorable decision? Is to attack the methodology and attack the risk manager, saying that, you know, whatever he's done is incorrect for some reason. It's much easier than, you know, accepting that risks are indeed too high.
Yes.
So the risk manager has to change his approach, change his methodology to support him being part of the decision making, to not be able to sit on the fence and actually have some additional insight to be brought into the decision. And I think that sort of leads me to the fourth and final key trend, is that to do this, modern day risk managers are just not built that way. They don't have, it's a very different, not only mindset, it's a different set of competencies to be able to stand up, to say justifiable arguments why something is a high risk. And I think there are like four things that every risk manager must know. They must know, of course, the standards and the legal frameworks. Mm-hmm. So different countries and different industries have different legal requirements on why they need to manage risk. Some associations, for example, in private equity, there's like a guide in Europe that tells this is how we manage risks in private equity. So you need to know the law, basically, and the ISO 31000. To have, you know, some foundation behind what you're saying. But the second big one is that have a very good appreciation of risk perception, risk psychology. Everything about cognitive biases, you need to be able to pick up all those sort of little triggers, because people say what they say not because they mean it, but because they system one thinking maybe just telling them what to say. You need to be able to pick up. You need to very quickly understand when somebody is lying to you on purpose, or they're just deceiving themselves and hence deceiving you. I, for example, had a rule: never under any circumstances discuss risks over the phone or via email. Because I needed to see the person face to face to immediately see, is he lying on purpose or is he just confused? And again, you know, people are not nice, but they're not evil either. So 95% of the time, they're just confused about not understanding what the implications are, what the risks are. Sometimes, of course, they're doing it on purpose. There's hidden agendas and corruption and so on. But reality is, you know, not everything is bad. So you need to really understand the science behind, as the risk professional, you need to understand the science behind behind the cognitive biases. And the third one is understanding all the quantitative tools, the Monte Carlo simulation, the scenario analysis, the decision trees, sensitivity analysis, all the tools that help you quantify, justify, present information in a way that is digestible by senior management.
And previous point, are you and Monte Carlo simulation are this sort of very statistically based analysis. Are you talking about understanding just how it works and how to read an output and how to kind of analyze it versus actually, you know, getting your, you know, your fingernails into the in dirty into the spreadsheets and the tools and, you know, building all of that stuff?
It's a good question, and I'm kind of, you know, slowly leading to that. No, I actually do think you need to understand how the tools work and use them and apply them. And even the most complicated things like Monte Carlo simulation doesn't really have to be that complex. I mean, technically speaking, you need like three data points for some of the distributions to be used in the analysis. I have a very good saying about Monte Carlo simulation. I'll probably just I'll mention it a little bit later. And so yes, I think you actually need to apply those tools to be able to be able to produce outcomes that don't say this risk is high, low, or medium, but say the what your business plan is great, but there's only about 10% chance of achieving that. And in fact, we may overrun the costs by between 1 and 5 million. Like, you need to have very clear logic behind what you are saying. You need to have ammunition, like proper ammunition. And the final, the sort of the final competency that is absolute must for the risk managers is understanding the business. And this, I mean, it sounds, you know, obvious and generic, but it's actually more than that. If, like, if you work for a pharmaceutical company, the risk manager needs to have a degree in science and understand how drugs are made. If it's like a manufacturing company, the risk manager needs an engineering degree. So you can imagine how weird it was for me, because my degree is risk management.
Yes.
I don't have any other proper degree except statistics. So it was quite tough. I mean, that was probably one of my one of my biggest challenges in life, is because I needed to understand how private equity works. I needed to understand how venture investment works. I needed to understand how, you know, solar generation works, or how pharmaceutical products are being made. And that, you know, everything I've said, this kind of leads you to one immediate thought. It is that there's no way in the world a single person can have all four
competencies. Yeah, so I was going to say that. I was going to ask. You know,
it's just physically impossible. And that essentially means that the risk management has to be done by a team where you have someone who understands business. Somebody who risk managers should probably recruit from the business, from the production or from the commerce department. They need to understand the intricate details of how decisions are made, to understand how you integrate risk management into those decisions. You need to have somebody with a math degree, and you need somebody who understands standards and so on. For me, because it was a small private equity fund, it was two people. So it was me knowing the sort of the business side and the standard side and the human side, and then I have a mathematician who did all the modeling and everything else. So risk management is not a single person show necessarily, based on what I've on what I've just said.
Yeah, it's you know, if I'm and I work professionally, and this is probably the most linked episode to what I do professionally. So I have to, I guess, be a little careful of what I say. But if I had, you know, an engineer, a psychologist, a mathematician, you know, on my team, that would be great. I wonder how many organizations are going to field a budget, you know, with those types of that type of skill set. And I think, yeah, it's an interesting question. I think we probably have a ways to go on
It is a challenge. But once you kind of, once you say we want to play with the big boys at the board table, then you need to bring them something that they will value equally as what they bring to the table.
Sure.
And that has certain implications for the risk professionals. And I mean, it's not. Like the unfortunate reality, it's not like the modern day risk management teams in many organizations. It's not like, oh, we've got everything, but we're missing the, you know, the psychologist, or we're missing the mathematician. Most risk management teams don't have 3 out of 4.
Right. Yeah.
So like it's okay if you don't have 1 out of 4. Yeah. But the reality is most organizations don't have 3 or all 4 out of 4.
Yes.
And that's, I think that's where the sort of the challenge is.
Yes. It's you know, it's fascinating stuff. And then when you take a couple of steps back and you look at the kind of macro picture, and you look at a number of the challenges that we face, whether it's climate change or terrorism or cyber attacks or pandemics. I mean, one of the things that, you know, if you look at one of the big risks out there in the world that I think doesn't get enough attention is antibiotic resistance. And that involves that. So there's pharmaceutical companies that need to get involved. There are hospitals, there are international organizations. And if we stick with the kind of approach that, you know, that's been around for ages, I'm not sure we'll ever get there. And that's So we do need to rethink how we look at risk in organizations and structurally how the systems are set up to create, you know, the sort of incentives around, you know, around some of the big risks that we're concerned about. The other thing that strikes me about what you're talking about is that I know you talk about risk management on a day-to-day basis, but there's only so much stuff that, you know, a risk person can get involved with at any point in time. So there has to be some type of prioritization around how much work is. If you're going to dive into a decision or whatever, you need the time and resource to be able to do that properly.
Absolutely.
So a couple of interesting questions there.
It's a big challenge. Well, I'll start with the second one. It's a huge challenge because decisions are made every day in every single department within the organization. Theoretically speaking, risk management should be everywhere.
Yes.
And the reality is there's only a number of set number of hours in a day.
Just the downside of the thinking fast, thinking slow. So we can't think slow on everything. You know, we need the fast system. If I were to, you know, look at my breakfast every day and say, well, how much does this have gluten in it, or do I, you know, this sort of thing, then all of a sudden I'm in trouble. So which we're already dealing with decision fatigue. So some of that, you know, thinking fast stuff is pretty valuable. So we need to know when to think fast and when to think slow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So the reality is the risk manager really has like three choices. Mm-hmm. And in the company, I mean, I'll talk about choices in day-to-day and like in our personal life. Mm-hmm. Risk management does help me with my personal life a lot. And I'll share some of that stories as well. But in the corporate world, risk manager really has three choices. Either if the decision is big enough and important enough, he needs to get involved himself and like do the calculations and stand up and discuss and talk about the outcomes. If the decisions are happening all the time and they're important, but they're not important enough, the risk manager needs to create a procedure, a process, or put it in play, integrate into the existing procedures, a step that will require people to stop and think about risks when they're doing something. So he changes the way business operates. In most of the things where he can't be himself, he changes the way business operates to make sure risks are at least considered. Like he gives people checklists, for example. He gives people cheat sheets or examples.
Right.
He puts in the procedure, he puts, before you make the next step, have a think about risks. And this is like, go to appendix 2 to see what the typical risks are. That's the kind of thing. That's the second approach. And the third approach is the risk manager decides that it is not critical important enough, so he will only get to that process when he has time. So he parks some of the processes. I mean, many processes get parked because he doesn't really have time. But they sort of the understanding of cognitive biases and appreciation of the science behind risk management and the science behind quantitative risk analysis, because when you one of the biggest lessons, again, I've learned is when you try to quantify something, you see that things that people usually talk about may not necessarily be that critical. When you put numbers behind it, it really puts things in the context. And some of the pandemics and some of the big issues that are front news for us, technically speaking or statistically speaking, may not really be such a huge issues at all.
I think terrorism is right up there with that.
Magnets.
I think terrorism is right up there as one of those things. I mean, statistically speaking, it's not the most significant thing that we're likely to perish from a terror attack.
Well, I mean, that's the kind of, that's the research I have discovered many, many years ago. There's an interesting, there's a graphical representation for that. There's basically a line and a bubble on top and the bubble on the bottom. And the size of the bubble on top shows you what people are usually scared about. So the terrorism, you know, sharks in Australia, for example, those are the things up there. And the bottom is sort of shows you the real risk exposure. And it's very different. For example, you know, when I sometimes when I say, you know, I'm from Australia and I used to swim there all the time. So people think about
sharks.
Which is great, but the reality is the risk of dying on the way to the beach is significantly higher than being bitten by a shark, and much more higher than actually dying from a shark bite. So you know, people really, our brain is weird when it comes to comes to risk. I kind of, as a rule, when somebody talks about something a lot, I start with the premise that it's probably not a really big issue. Like it's probably, it's either because it's a popular thing or it's because it's trying to hide something else. And I mean, like all the geopolitical conflict lately, like anything you hear about, it's just a distraction from something really important happening somewhere else. So you know, risk mind gives you interesting perspectives and gives you ability to appreciate information, I think, a little bit more, and it gives you the tools in your day-to-day life. For example, for me, I mean, that was just a fascinating story. For me, for all my training activities and education, I used to have a bank account in the Russian bank that was dedicated to small and medium-sized businesses. It was a very popular, quite a big bank. And at the end of the year, it was many years ago, at the end of the year, all my sort of invoices came in for the from the training I did for the MBAs and the different business schools. And as I normally do, I sort of started putting the payments to my all the different other accounts to pay the credit card and all the other things. And this one instance, I kind of delayed the processing of payments. So it was almost 31st of December. And even though the sort of the bank usually processes within the same day, technically they have three business days.
Yes.
So technically they were right not to process my payment just before the New Year's, and they should have done it, like they would have done it after the holidays. In Russia, New Year holidays are like 10 days, so it was almost 2 weeks later. And when the holidays passed, I felt absolutely normal, like nothing was out of the ordinary. I saw that on the first day after the holiday, the money didn't go out. It still stayed in my account. So I've done like as any person would do. I picked up the phone and I called the call center. And this is what happened next. Like 99 of the people in the world will probably ignore this information, but not the risk manager. He is built to recognize signs and warning bells. So this is what happened. I called the call center and nobody answered. And I'm like, okay, I call back. So I call back immediately and I waited for like, you know, five beeps and nobody answered. So I called back. Somebody picked up the phone and put it back. And I thought, well, that's just like, that's unusual. And then I called the third time and the lady picked up and she gave me like the perfect explanation. Everything sounded like very, very legit. She said, technical issues, we're deeply sorry and everything was fixed by the end of the week. So it was like, it was Wednesday, so I only had like 2 days to wait. Like everything was normal. She apologized many times. So it was a very normal conversation like you may have with the bank. And my brain told me, don't worry about it. Let's wait until the end of the week and then we'll figure it out. And my system two thinking switched on and said, something's not right. The bank call center does not put a phone down and does not pick up. It's a multi-line service.
It's their job,
Exactly. So something's not right. So imagine it's evening, it's snowy, it's winter. I feel tired and dreadful, and I make my way across the whole city to get to the bank, to my branch, and I get there. Everything's normal, like people just doing their job, like nothing out of ordinary at all. And so I come to the employee and I go, can I, you know, extract the money in cash if I can't transfer it, if you have different technical issues? And they say, yeah, sure, like no problem, but we have a limit on cash withdrawals, which is like few thousand dollars at the time. And I'm going, okay, now I know everything. Like something's not right. The bank's probably going to lose the license in a week or so. And I extracted all my money that day. I came in the second day, and there was nobody in the line when I first came. On the second day, there were like 10 people in the line. So I came the second day and extracted the other portion of my money. On the third day, there was 100 people in the line. And I only had a small bit left, so I extracted that. And I had all my money out of the bank. It lost its license within months.
Wow.
And it stopped giving cash out the next day I stopped, but then it sort of dragged on for weeks.
Wow.
Not losing the license, and that means until it loses the license, the insurance doesn't kick in.
Yeah.
So people were really, really stuck. Like, they couldn't get the access to money from the bank or from the insurance company. So it's just, it's weird how our mind works like that. You see something and your brain tells you, ignore it, it's nothing. And your risk management mind tells you, just verify, just double check. Maybe there is something behind it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that type of scenario is, to be honest, not very likely in the UK or the US, but it has happened, and I think your risk management skills certainly served you well, and I think if that were to happen in the US or the UK or Canada, it would be 99% of the people, and maybe it'd be 99.9% of the people who wouldn't pay too much attention. I wanted to actually wrap things up soon, but you had something to say about Monte Carlo analysis, which is this major statistical. It's called Monte Carlo's because you put lots of variables into a spreadsheet, and it gives you an output based on lots of random variables or risks. But you had something to say about it that you wanted to get back to.
Sure, sure. I have a quote which I just love. Monte Carlo is, in essence, is like a complicated scenario analysis. When you just try and vary few things in the overall sort of business plan or the budget or schedule, and see what if, basically. What if the foreign exchange between euro and pound will be different? What if your interest rates will be different? What if the customers don't what if the equipment doesn't come next week or the week after? It's basically like scenario analysis, but slightly more complex. And I just love this quote. One of the students summarized some of the training that we've done. So I don't remember saying that, but that's his impression of me saying something about Monte Carlo. Monte Carlo doesn't tell us what the future holds, but it does help us validate the version of the future selected by top management. And I love that, because this is what risk management is all about. We don't predict the future. We're not going to come in and come out and say, we think this project will have cost overruns of this.
Yeah.
But what we certainly can say is that you, management, are making your decision based on the assumptions that you've done. You think the future will look like this. Well, we've done our analysis. We actually think that the likelihood of the future looking like you want it to look is very, very low. And in fact, the future may look very different, and you need to take that into consideration when making the decision right
Absolutely. Now. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great way of putting it. And we're not, you know, soothsayers. We don't have crystal balls and this kind of a thing. But it's a great way of presenting how, as you say, how management thinks the future will look, and what the likelihood of that might be. You know, we didn't answer the question of how you got to Barcelona. So before we go, I think you have to touch on that.
Yeah, it's a good question. Again, and that was a very smart risk management move. At some stage, our family decided to move outside of Russia. Economically, Russia stopped being an exciting place because the currency lost 130%. It's kind of rebounded a little bit, but it's still more than 60% different to when I started. That means that all the income received in Russian rubles diminished significantly when converted to the European currency, and we've decided that it would be a better place for the family to generate income in a different currency than the Russian ruble. So we've decided, we kind of had the place in Spain already by that stage, and we've decided to move to Spain, and For the last year, I've really been focusing on contributing to the ISO 31000 development. I help with the training and certification, still in Russia and some in the Middle East. And I've finally had the time to publish the second book that me and my colleague Elena Demidenko have done, and it's available completely for free on the Risk Academy website. It's now even easier to find. You can just Google "free risk management book."
Okay,
and it kind of comes out as you know one of the top choices. So I've tried to create. I've obviously been spending time a lot with my family, and that gave me a wonderful opportunity to go out to the sea or the mountains and shoot a lot of videos.
Yeah, I love your videos. Like very good. Yeah.
160 something videos with on different risk management topics, like why risk maps are bad, or you know why risk appetite is nonsense.
I'll put
why risk frameworks.
Yeah, I'll put those in the show notes for people. And you know, again, very few risk management people are thinking like this and using social media and videos and this type of thing to connect with others. So it's very valuable, very cool what you're doing. And Risk Academy is this online community that you've created and set up. Where can people find you and find Risk Academy and all of that good stuff?
Risk Academy has a number of things. It has a lot of templates that are published for free and are downloadable off the website. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of articles, basically anything I publish that's available on the Risk Academy website. It has the free book. Mm-hmm. It actually has two free books. The first one, which I created first in 2011, and the second one, which we just published in January. And it has a lot of training, online training courses that are available both for free. It has some paid content as well. But most of it is really just me trying to give back to the community some of the lessons that I've learned. So some people appreciate my sort of take on things. Some people violently disagree with it, but at least it's worth considering.
What types of people violently disagree with you, Alex? You seem like an agreeable guy. So what are the big points of contention that you get?
Well, I think the reality is, and again, this is to my mind, it's completely understandable because I know how cognitive biases work. The biggest really pushback I had from a lot of consultants and people who are selling something that I know for a fact doesn't work.
Sure.
But for them, it would mean completely redo the whole product offering, change their approach, change their mindset.
Yes.
For them, it's just too much of a mind shift.
Yes.
And you know, it's fine. It takes time. You know, people really have two choices when they see something that contradicts their sort of point of view. The confirmation bias is they go, okay, that's interesting. It's worth thinking about. Mm. Or they go, no, my brain tells me it's all rubbish. And like, why would I believe someone? Yes. I've been doing this for 10, 15, you know, 20, 30 years.
That's a dangerous place. I mean, what was interesting, you didn't just say there that, and then some people just change their mind like that. I don't think most people are like that. I think something new, it kind of chips away at you and you give a little bit more attention and you, sooner or later, you might get to a place where, okay, I really have to change the way I think about this.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm trying to use a lot of sort of, you know, social media and video formats to appeal to the people who are thinking of moving into the risk space and are not, they're not corrupted by the old type of thinking. Like they don't have a lot of baggage behind them.
Yeah.
So they can start with the fresh piece of paper with the right messages in it. And I think the other sort of type of people who disagree with some of the things I'm saying are smart people because they realize that what I'm saying is actually really difficult. I'm basically saying don't sit in your office and do whatever you can do by yourself. You have to go out and speak and you have to get all those inputs and you have to build not one but dozens relationships and you have to convince other people to give you access to their information to then do the analysis.
Yeah, it is difficult.
It's really tough.
Yeah, it is difficult. And, you know, you're talking about a really fundamental shift in the way this works across many industries. And that takes time. It doesn't happen overnight and it's a battle. So some people want to get into that, you know, that battle. They see the value of it. But others, I would imagine, particularly if you're sort of later in the career, maybe not. I don't know, but others just that's just too much work, too mentally taxing, and
Is absolutely true. It is in fact very mentally consuming and difficult. I mean, that's probably, I'm saying I've moved because, you know, the economy in Russia has changed. Mm-hmm. It could be one of the reasons why I have resigned as the head of risk. Although one of my closest friends and allies is now the new head of risk of the company where I work. So he's continuing that legacy of driving and integrating. But the reality is it has a huge mental strain, and it requires a person who is ready to be an opponent. And you know, it's not always easy to be an opponent to a vice president or a CFO who have a lot of power and knowledge and data.
I think it also takes a leader that wants to be challenged in an organization, or leaders that want to be challenged, and not everybody does.
Well, that's actually a very fair point. Many organizations are not yet there where they want the true view of risks. Some organizations are comfortable with risk registers on a quarterly basis, and, because, you know, they don't want to see the truth.
Yeah, and it's not something that's limited to Russia, although I imagine there are certain corporate governance issues in Russia that contribute to it. But, you know, the Lehman Brothers, you know, Bear Stearns, you know, where risk management was ignored, Barings Bank several years ago when Nick Leeson took down the organization, Volkswagen. You have examples across the world where this occurs, so it can happen anywhere. But the way the governance arrangements work can help or not, that type of thing. But ultimately, it comes down to an individual as well, you know, and do I want to be challenged, or do I not? And that can be, regardless of where you are, can be the core issue.
Exactly. So, you know, to do risk management right, it's a pretty tough job that requires a person of a certain mindset,
yes,
and the senior management of a certain certain mindset. Just because everything we do is really against human nature.
Yes.
It's like we're doing something that is not...
Yes, it's hard, yeah.
Not how we've been designed.
It's fascinating, but it's difficult. And that's what makes it, you know, a great profession in my view. And that's also why, you know, it's great to have these types of conversations, because the more that people become aware of these things, I think the better that we all are.
Something that just before we wrap up, something you've just said triggered an interesting thought in my mind, and then maybe we can sort of finish on that. I think by just saying everything I've said out loud, we kind of come to the conclusion that risk management as a profession may be too tough to challenge. Like it may be just unrealistic to think that a single person or a single team within the company can change how decisions are being made. And maybe the sort of the future, I've kind of talked about the four trends on how the risk manager should change himself in the company, but maybe the answer is somewhere completely different. Maybe we need to move towards accepting that risk management is not a profession, it's a tool, and it's a tool that should be used and taught to the executives, and they need to be applying that on their sort of on their day-to-day basis. When I participated in the development of the PwC Global Risk Methodology many years ago, I went around the offices and I had a slide where I said, my vision of risk management by 2020, there wouldn't be a risk manager. Because the business will be risk-based, it will be integrated into how decisions are made. And I now understand that this is physically impossible. Because of the cognitive biases, because of the hidden agendas, because of the self-interest, because of the conflict of interest within the organizations, because business is not necessarily nice all the time, is that that's physically impossible. So there probably still needs to be a risk professional who will go and nag and remind and gently nudge and push people in the right direction. But maybe as the profession, our best option is to convince the rest of the world is that risk management is not a profession, but a tool, and make it part of the tool set of all the executives. For example, I've done a lot to integrate risk management courses into executive MBA and MBA programs. So it becomes part of the tool set. That's clearly not enough. We somehow need to make risk management just one of the tool sets, and maybe that will sort of create the foundation for the risk manager to then do his job properly.
Yeah, and maybe we need to go beyond the business courses. Maybe we go into any and all realms of thinking. Alex, I think we covered a lot, so I wanted to thank you very much for coming on the show. I think we've covered off where people can find you, but I will put everything in the show notes. So if you are interested in learning more about Alex and his work, you can go there and everything will be there. Alex, thank you so much. I really appreciate this. This was a lot of fun.
Ben, thank you so much again for the opportunity. I enjoyed this a lot. And I do encourage all the listeners, if you want to continue this conversation, just find me on LinkedIn and add me to your connections. And you'll see a lot of the articles that I publish. And some of them are outrageous and some of them are just fun.
Perfect. Alex, thank you so much. And all the best, and let's stay connected.
Thank you. Speak to you later.
Bye. I hope you guys enjoyed that. As always, check out the show notes and connect with Alex and continue the conversation. He's a very accessible and insightful guy, as you heard. If you have any feedback on the show or on this episode, drop me a note. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to do that. Hit me up on Twitter, @riskthings is the handle. Would love to hear from you. Check out allthingsrisk.co.uk as always, and you can find all the ways in which you can subscribe to the show and sign up for our newsletter. I've got a few things planned. I'm still cooking them up in my head, but a few things will be coming over the next few months, including a live webinar and panel discussion, as well as a few other goodies. So if you check out allthingsrisk.co.uk, sign up for the newsletter, you won't miss a thing. And if you haven't yet subscribed to the show, you can also find every which way you can do that on our website. We will be back next week, as always. And in the interim, don't forget, risk is life.